This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. Today, we are going to showcase a selection of features from our newsroom and beyond. In 2023, the Oregon legislature created a plan for more recovery high schools for teens with substance use disorder. But Governor Tina Kotek's recent proposed budget cuts back on what was promised. Sandy Stack with the Southern Oregon Education Service District has been working to create a recovery high school in Jackson County. JPR's Jane Vaughn recently spoke with Stack about her work, the need for more recovery high schools, and what might happen to the project now.
So we're here today to talk about a potential funding hurdle to open a new recovery high school in Jackson County. First off, can you tell me what a recovery high school is?
An Oregon Recovery School is a public school in Oregon that is a school of choice for teenagers that are in recovery from substance use disorders. It's a small school community designed to be small intentionally, to have a community of peers with the same kind of similar lived experiences, to support each other in their goals of sobriety and graduation. We're working on providing a high quality education, but also integrating comprehensive substance use services and mental health services for students.
And so tell me about your efforts. I know you've been working to try to create a recovery high school here in Jackson County. What has that process been like?
So the conversation actually started a little over a year ago with our Director of Student Services and Jackson Care Connect at a behavioral health summit, where they were really doing a needs assessment of the whole region, what's happening with our youth and substance use and mental health. So around that same time, the state of Oregon had passed House Bill 2767, which allowed the Oregon Department of Education to open up to 9 recovery high schools across the state over a handful of upcoming bienniums. So, of course, our region thought that's an absolutely amazing opportunity for our students. So the Oregon Department of Education just opened up the request for application on March 31st. It closes at the end of April, and they plan to notify people in May if they get the contract to be able to open up a recovery school for this next school year, the 2025-2026 school year. We've been spending time really developing operational plans, a 3-year budget, forming partnerships with different community organizations to really leverage all of the existing resources we have within our community to make sure that we are really going to successfully meet the needs of our students. And right now, we're just finalizing the pieces of our application to be ready to submit to the Oregon Department of Education by the end of the month.
But I understand there's been a little bit of maybe a hiccup, that there might not be as much funding as you maybe thought, that maybe this recovery high school might not happen. Can you tell me about that?
So the funding has definitely shifted a bit over the last couple of months. We actually anticipated that the Oregon Department of Education was going to be opening up the request for applications in February for potentially up to 3 additional recovery high schools. That actually was delayed a couple of months, I believe, because of the state funding and just the barriers that were starting to be in place with the governor's recommended budget. It sounded like the full amount that the Oregon Department of Education was requesting for those 3 additional recovery high schools was not included at that full amount, not fully funded in the recommended budget. So the request for application has opened, and it seems like the intent of the Oregon Department of Education is to approve 1 additional recovery school with the potential of approving 2 more later, maybe September-ish, once the state budget is actually finalized.
Okay, so some funding challenges statewide. You had thought there would be money for 3 more schools statewide. Now sounds like only 1 immediately, and then potentially 2 in the future. So you're submitting your application with the hope that you will be the one that is picked. And if it's not picked now, maybe to be picked in the fall.
Absolutely. And we're really confident that our application is going to be really strong and really paint the picture of the unique needs and challenges in our area and how a recovery school really does provide a solution to so many of those challenges. We wouldn't be able to open without the state funding.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Sandy.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was JPR's Jane Vaughn speaking with Sandy Stack, a Recovery Supports Project Manager at the Southern Oregon Education Service District. Arts organizations in Oregon are feeling the pinch. Advocates say the state ranks near the bottom when it comes to state funding for the arts, and recent cuts to federal arts programs are only adding to the challenge. KLCC's Kendra Shertel and Sejina Stresta have the story.
It's a sunny April afternoon at the Oregon Capitol, and several arts advocates from Lane County are gathered outside the office of Senator James Manning, a Eugene Democrat. They're one of many groups here for the Arts and Culture Advocacy Day, hoping to convince lawmakers to invest more in the arts.
Hi, how are you doing? Come on in, have a seat.
We are so excited to be here today to talk to you about arts and culture and some ways that we can support.
I support it.
Yeah.
Don't you know it?
Your work is done. Yeah.
We thank you for your...
As a member of the Oregon Legislature's Arts and Culture Caucus, Manning says the arts have always held a special place in his life.
One thing I've always believed in is the art, because I found that even when I was in high school years ago, the art, theater, music and stuff, they keep you out of trouble. They give you an avenue to do something, to be creative and stuff.
That kind of personal connection to the arts is something advocates hope will resonate throughout the legislature. Among them is Claire Blaylock, a caucus coordinator with the Cultural Advocacy Coalition Foundation. She says House Bill 3189 would raise the Oregon Arts Commission budget from $4 million to $10 million, something she says is long overdue.
So we're serving more people with the same amount of funds that we were serving in, 2006. So that's not acceptable. We need to grow that. I think we jump between ranking 39th and 41st for arts funding for per capita. And this is kind of ironic because Oregon ranks the first in the country for the number of individuals who make donations to arts and culture. And what we're asking for is the state to start reflecting that incredible level of individual support.
Blaylock says without more state support, smaller and rural arts organizations often fall through the cracks, especially now that federal programs are being scaled back.
The importance of the work is underscored, frankly, by the level of chaos that we're seeing at the federal level with the dismantling of the National Endowment for Humanities and the Institute of Museum and Library Services. What the loss of those funding entities means is actually pretty catastrophic, especially for a state like Oregon, because what people don't understand is that a lot of it has gone to support small to mid-size rural arts and culture institutions.
One of those smaller arts organizations is in Benton County. My colleague, Sejina Shresta, picks up the story from here.
In early April, the Benton County Historical Society released a joint statement with a handful of arts and culture organizations in the Corvallis area. The letter outlined how cuts to federal arts funding would impact the community. Jessica Haugen, the executive director at the Historical Society, says she wanted to make sure people understood what was changing.
There are so many things happening at the federal level every single day, and we really wanted to make sure that people in our community understood what the impacts of some of those changes were going to be on our local community.
As my colleague Kendra explained, cuts to federal agencies that gave out grants to arts and culture organizations have had a ripple effect throughout Oregon. For the Benton County Historical Society, Haugen says these changes meant the nonprofit had to postpone hiring more staff.
We have one full-time staff member dedicated to caring for over 140,000 artifacts in our collection now, and she's doing a phenomenal job, but one person for that many artifacts is not nearly enough. We really need to find support to expand our staffing to care for our collection.
With less grant money in the market, Haugen says other types of funding will be harder to come by.
What is going to happen directly from that is there is immediately going to be a lot more competition for regional and state and local funding from every kind of funding source.
And that's why arts organizations took their message to lawmakers in Salem. Kendra Shertel picks up the story once again.
Thanks, Sejina. Back at the state capitol, Senator Manning sends the arts supporters on their way, but not before offering them some encouragement and a reality check.
And everybody come here has a great potential for a good project. So yours is greater. But then, you're also looking at what's going on, cutting Medicare and Medicaid and stuff. How is that going to impact people's quality of life stuff? I think it's going to be devastating.
Amid shrinking federal support, Oregon arts advocates say even modest state investments can go a long way. Between 2019 and 2023, Oregon received about $28 million in federal arts and culture funding, supporting nearly 200 projects, many in rural communities. Advocates like Claire Blaylock say those dollars are well spent, and they want the state to step it up too.
And Oregon in general has so many absolute gems of arts and culture institutions, both small and large. Arts and culture, we're not extra. We are not something that's nice to have. We are something that is absolutely vital. It is like the air you breathe.
In Salem, I'm Kendra Shertel.
And I'm Sujina Shrestha, reporting.
In recent years, the population of homeless people has aged, with about 20% of them now 55 or older. Many have never been homeless before, and as Jefferson Public Radio's Jane Vaughn reports, there are specific difficulties with helping homeless seniors.
Gregory Sovic grew up in East L.A., but he ended up in Redding, California after a series of family deaths and financial losses.
And I just hung out with nothing else to do. And being without my tools, I couldn't work anymore.
He used to be a dog groomer, but ended up living on the streets, making money in other ways.
The price of everything, I couldn't afford it. And so I just made it out there the best I could, fixing bicycles for people and building bike trailers, you know, for the homeless and stuff, surviving that way, which wasn't very much of a survival.
Sovic isn't alone in this. With rents increasing and Social Security not keeping pace, many older adults are simply being priced out of their homes and finding themselves on the streets.
I'm old enough that when I started in this work, we were like, oh, Social Security solves homelessness, and now it doesn't.
That's Dr. Margot Cushell, director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. She says people over 50 are most likely to spend more than half of their income on rent. Cushell says in her research, she's seen many people like Sovic, who work their entire lives in low-wage, physically demanding jobs with no money left over for savings.
And then after the age of 50, something happened. They got sick. Their spouse or partner got sick. They couldn't keep up their physically demanding work. Their marriage broke up.
She says almost half have never been homeless before, and being older and homeless comes with special challenges. Sometimes housing options are physically inaccessible, like a third-floor walk-up. And Cushell says older homeless people have high rates of chronic disease and incredibly high mortality rates. They also have to deal with normal age-related things, like dementia and end-of-life care. All of that takes a physical toll.
We've observed that by the time people experiencing homelessness are in their early 50s, their health is really much more similar to people in their 70s and 80s in the general population.
Hearts for Seniors focuses on one part of this problem, helping older adults with whatever they need, whether it's getting food or fixing up their house. Stephanie Miller is the director.
When we hear about these seniors who are going to be evicted, if they don't have clear pathways, we try to get teams that can go in and help keep them in their homes.
A team of volunteers fans out to seniors' homes each week.
We've helped with like home modification, saved a lot of seniors from eviction by, you know, doing big yard projects or helping them paint their home or put a new roof on, build ramps, railings.
Miller says they serve 80 to 90 seniors a week in Jackson, Josephine, and Lincoln counties. One of them is 82-year-old Bob Welch in Medford. He relies on Social Security and broke his hip falling on the unstable front steps of his house. Hearts for Seniors helped him out.
I come home to the hospital and I had a yard full of carpenters, you know, building me a ramp.
He speaks very highly of the program and says the best part is the weekly hangouts he gets with one of the volunteers, who arrives while we're talking.
This is my buddy. Come on in, Mark.
But for older people who do become homeless, finding their way back into housing can be difficult and tedious. Gregory Sovic lived on the streets of Redding for 10 years before he finally was able to get a housing voucher and move into an apartment. He thought it would never happen. At age 64, he now spends his days drawing, painting, and reading the Bible.
I'm a domesticated male.
He's a house cat.
Yeah.
But even though Sovic has been helped into housing, there are still thousands more just like him, who, after a lifetime of work, are living out their golden years on the streets. I'm Jane Vaughn reporting.
Thank you to JPR's own Jane Vaughn and to our partners at KLCC for these stories. And that's it for today's JX. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more, or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
On Tuesday's Jefferson Exchange, what happens when the federal government makes public media a public enemy? We'll talk with the heads of both JPR and Southern Oregon PBS to learn more about the local response to a growing national problem. And the Oregon State Legislature addresses the growing problem of fraudulent ticket sales. I'm Mike Green. That's Tuesday on the Jefferson Exchange, live at 9 a.m. with a repeat at 8 p.m. on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.